Very, very exciting that this has gone ahead. I just want to say thank you from the get-go, because otherwise we wouldn't have access to all these articles. I grew up myself reading Rip It Up, so it's been very formative for me. So it's to be able to place it kind of like on a timeline now has been really, really amazing. Yeah.
Well, I think it's just such an important magazine. It's really hard to understate how important Rip It Up was to the New Zealand music industry.
Totally.
It made us stop cringing about our music. And, I'm old enough to remember when it first arrived and New Zealand music wasn't played on any radio stations. It was hard to play on student radio at that stage.
Really?
And, then Murray turned up with this magazine called Rip It Up. And it said, this stuff is good, this is important. And it put New Zealand artists on the cover 100 times in the first 8 years.
Right out the front.
Yeah.
So what was the local music scene kind of like at the time in 1977 when it first started?
Dire. Very, very dire. It was so bad that in 1977 they cancelled the music awards because there was nothing to celebrate.
Really?
Yeah. There was the odd good record coming out, and there were a few interesting bands, but not that many.
Right.
And there was a massive sales tax on music, so the government had put on a 40% sales tax on records.
Just local ones or internationals as well?
No, all records.
Far
what that meant was, in 1974, I think it was, the price of an LP was $4.75. Now, it doesn't sound very much now, but back then that was a reasonable amount of money.
Definitely.
And 10 years later, it was $15 for the same record. So that's like 300% price rise in 3 years. Sorry, in 10 years.
Far out.
Because all these taxes and things on them.
And what were the reasons for the taxes,
Oh, it's just government thought they could tax music, and they didn't think... the Prime Minister at the time Rip It Up turned up was Robert Muldoon, who famously said that music wasn't culture.
Sure, Ralph.
we were all going, what the fuck?
That's shocking.
Absolutely shocking. So he came out and he said music's not culture. So, but then this thing turned up called punk rock, and it arrived from nowhere, and Rip It Up arrived at the same time. So all of a sudden there was this new life happened in the scene. And there was an explosion. They sort of went hand in hand. And Murray was incredibly supportive of the new music. As I said before, it's kind of impossible to say how much influence he had, how important it really was, because there was no mass media. There was no internet, of course. But there was no media to tell people about the music we were making. The bands were playing around town. There was nothing. There was the Sunday newspapers, which might have a little column. There's the daily newspapers might have a little column every now and again.
Mm-hmm.
But that was it.
Far out. So once Hot Licks, the predecessor kind of to Rip It Up, had closed in 1976, was there anybody writing about local music? There was just literally nothing.
Not an awful lot.
The
sporadic thing. It was, as I say, there was a UTA column in the Sunday newspapers and the Truth, and so they all had what they call a sound reporter or the sound guy or something like that, who would write these filly sort of shocky sort of stories, which was great for punk. And we first turned up with punk bands, they loved us, so they could write these like filth and horror sort of stories about us. And there was no credible coverage of New Zealand popular music or New Zealand music full stop.
Right. And at the time, punk was obviously reasonably abrasive to the general public. Was there anything that Rip It Up wouldn't cover, being that punk was kind of at the front of what they were doing in a lot of senses?
No, they kind of covered everything. I mean, one of my favourite pages, I've forgotten about it until we went online recently, was a page where they did a half-page interview with Dolly Parton, and the country singer, and it's a great story. It's it's taking Dolly Parton away from being a Dolly Bird and saying this is a strong woman who's made her own mind up to be what she wants to be, And the other half of the page was a Toy Love band file.
Oh, wow.
So you had the Toy Love, you know, punk rock, and then you had Dolly Parton, the country singer, on the same page.
What a beautiful intersection.
Yeah.
That's so great.
And Murray covered... So Murray had to cover everything. There was still the tail end of what they call prog rock at the time, but there was also all this new music as well. And then into that came in the independent labels, of which I was one of the first.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also records like AK-79 turned up and a whole lot of stuff like that. So it was like this meeting of all these strands. The bands were there, the magazine had turned up, and music was starting to be made and recorded.
Right, right.
So all of a sudden you had an industry.
All within the space of like a year or so.
Well, maybe 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Develop momentum. And then you had venues. So there was, in 77 there were venues, of course, but there were only a few in Auckland, maybe 2 or 3. And there was the Glue Pot and the Windsor Castle and a couple of other ones. But on the back of all this stuff, all these underground venues and like little pubs and clubs started opening up. So you had a thriving live scene as well.
That's incredible.
It was a real golden age.
Totally, totally, totally. And Murray said that a lot of the core writers for those early days of Rip It Up came largely out of Crackham. Were a lot of the bands coming out of there as well because of that?
Well, Crackham was one place we did get some support, media-wise. But even then, it wasn't huge.
Yeah.
But there was coverage of what was going on. And the early punk bands got some coverage there too, but it was quite tongue-in-cheek. I suppose it was. The editor of Crackham at that stage was a guy called Frank Stark, who had a band called Junk.
That's a great name.
And they were like a punky type band, like almost like a post-punk band before post-punk turned up, real angular music. Most of the bands, a lot of the early bands came out of the art schools, and things like Elam and the ATI, as it was then, School of Graphics Arts, which gave us the Scavengers. The Suburban Reptiles came out of Auckland University. They were an Elam band.
And so that's when you first got involved with writing with Rip It Up as well, right?
No, I first got involved with writing Rip It Up. I went to Australia in late 79 for a few months. When I came back from Australia, I got a job working or managing a record shop in High Street. Taste Records, and we were kind of like we thought we were quite an edgy sort of record shop, and Murray used to come in all the time with magazines, and then one day he asked me to write a review, and I reviewed a record, and it was Mental as Anything second album, and then he said to me, he just started a second magazine, which only lasted a few issues, called Ripped Up Extra, and he said, would I write a history of the punk scene?
Oh, wow.
And this was probably the first major thing I ever did. I think it was the second thing that was ever published under my name. And so I wrote this 3-page history of Zwines in the punk scene.
Wow, that's incredible. And so what was the idea behind Rip It Up Extra as a format?
Well, Rip It Up Extra was supposed to be for the big pieces of writing that didn't fit into Rip It Up.
Mm-hmm.
So and things like that. There were a lot of like long form stories in there, but unfortunately, you know, it wasn't that much advertising to go around to cover the cost. So I think Murray decided to focus everything on Rip It Up.
Right, right.
And he started expanding some of the stories in Rip It Up at that stage into a more long form as well.
And have those Rip It Up Extra articles been digitized too?
No, we'll get there.
Oh, that's good to know. That is good to know. Because you bought the Rip It Up archives in 2016. Who had them at that point?
Grant Hislop. Grant Hislop was the previous owner. And he had bought it off Satellite Media in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd made it free again, but I think it's time to kind of pass. And so he, in 2015, he shut the magazine down.
Right.
And then about 6 months later, somebody sent me a message and said, have you seen this on Trade Me? And it was just an anonymous thing saying New Zealand Music Magazine for sale.
Whoa.
And I went, really?
A cane?
Well, there's only one magazine it can be, really, isn't it?
Far out.
So I approached him, and I think the advert said you could buy the whole magazine as a going concern, or you could buy the archives. So I went in there, and the price was fairly high. So I negotiated with Grun and negotiated them down. I said, look, I just want the archives. I have no desire to go out there and set up a new magazine. It's not what I do, and I don't think the time is right for anyone to run a magazine.
Yeah.
And so we negotiated a deal, and I bought the archives. And then he turned up at my storage space with a trailer full of boxes.
Wow.
And it was 27 or 30 large cardboard boxes of magazines and photographs and written archives and all sorts of stuff like that. And said, there you go. And I signed a contract. And, so I purchased all that. And there were literally thousands, and there still are in my storage space, thousands and thousands and thousands of photographs, which I haven't really fully gone through. And a lot of them are international photographs. So I've got, like, you know, more pictures of Kylie Minogue than anyone ever really needs.
Wow.
And lots of that sort of stuff. But there's also a ton of New Zealand band photographs, some of which I've managed to pull out and scan.
Awesome.
And there are a lot of discs in there of the issues from about 1996 through to 2011, where it was all on disc.
Yeah.
And so I've got all those, and I need to sit down. I've gone through them quickly and pulled out photographs and things, and some of those photographs are on Audio Culture now. And then in 2017, I think it was, when I was talking to the National Library, we thought, well, we need to secure the rights to use the name on this. We'd finally agreed to do the digitization thing, and we needed to secure the name. So I then went out there and looked for the rights to who owned the name, because I thought Grant obviously owns the name.
Mm.
And then I did a little search and discovered that Satellite Media still owned the name.
Well, they hadn't transferred over.
They'd never transferred it to Grant. They were still paying for the rights to the name and the intellectual property, which was the name and masthead Ripperdup. So I went to Satellite Media and said, can I buy the name and the trademark off you? And they said, sure. So I bought that off them, which meant that I kind of owned the whole lot by that stage.
That's incredible.
I was able to do the digitization at that stage.
So like some issues had like tens of thousands of copies of them, but were all of the copies found in the archive, or did some need to be found from outside of what you'd got from Grant?
I've got one copy of every single issue of Ripperdup.
Wow.
But I didn't want to destroy the official Ripperdup, you know, my archive. And so when I was starting to work with the National Library, they've got a complete set of Ripperdups too, every single Ripperdup. And they said, we don't want to destroy ours as well. You know, the process of scanning it is you have to pull these things apart and scan them. And with the early Ripperdups, they're all folded. So yeah. You can probably put them back together again, refold them up, and you've got the Ripperdup again, but it's not 100% guaranteed. And so Chris Burke said to me, I've got a complete set of those Ripperdups up to 1985, and if they're digitized, I don't need my physical copies necessarily anymore. So I just need them for reference, because he's a journalist, and that's why he has them.
Yeah.
And so he gifted those first issues to the National Library and to the process.
Oh my goodness, that's so generous.
To be scanned. Wow. And we're hoping they all come back and he can get his issues back, but if he doesn't, that's how we got the physical issues.
Far out. So super generous.
And the reason he only went up to 1985, this particular time, is that was at the end of 1985 when they stopped being folded and they started being stapled. So we then have to find a set from 1985 through to 1998, which we can destroy.
Because what does the process kind of entail, do you know, when it comes to what the National Library are doing with the archive?
Well, the first thing that has to be done is they've got to send them all off to this company in India that does it. Because it's a government department, they have to go and get the cheapest rate. The cheapest offer they had was a company in India, so who professionally scanned magazines and archives and stuff like that. So all these magazines had to be, they were all photocopied in New Zealand, or photographed in New Zealand, just like roughly, so we knew it was there.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sent across to India, and the Indian company literally took them apart and put them on top of these huge machines and scanned them.
Wow.
Dissected. And then we had to make a decision. We had to make a decision as to how they were going to look on the site, because there were, if we'd gone completely black and white, we would have lost the photographic stuff on this, on the pages, like the grayscale photographs.
Yeah.
And so we had to make a decision to reduce the quality of the text a little bit, and it's gone a little bit grayish, so that you can still see the photographs and you can still understand how it looked in situ.
Certainly worth it, no doubt.
Yeah. And if people want to turn it into a more readable, you know, a more pure black and white thing, so they can read it, they can just put it through Photoshop or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
It'll
do
it. Click of a button.
Fantastic. And is there a plan to do if one was found, like a second set of the following articles, I guess, after 1985? Is the idea to eventually have them all digitized?
Yeah. Well, the second step, which is what we're trying to really do as fast as we can, is to do 1986 through to 1998. Now, 98 is the cover of the next one, because it's when Murray left. So Murray walked away in 1998 and stopped editing the magazine. And then you've got the next, if we do the third one, the magazine format changed after that, into a big sort of tabloid size thing. That's quite a different process as well.
Yeah, and that's the era that I remember for sure.
Yeah, so that's a much harder thing to do. And fortunately, those ones there, I think every issue of that, I've got about 7 or 8 copies of each of those.
Oh, wow.
So there's no problem finding those.
Yeah. I was going to say, I've got some at home if you need them.
Well, that's what we might have to do for the 1986 to 1998, just put out a call out and say, what have you got there?
Right.
And who wants to be a hero? And because you will lose your magazines this time around for sure.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that we can help get the word out there. No doubt.
Yeah. I think now that it's out there, I mean, the traffic has been huge on the Papers Past site, we're told. So now that they're out there and people know it and they're appreciating it, I think there's a real... I don't think there'd be a problem finding those issues when we decide to do it.
No doubt.
But
no
to be honest, Fred, this has been pretty exhausting so far, getting this organised.
Understandably.
There's been a lot of like rights issues and stuff. We had to get all the photographers we could find and say, do you mind? And nobody, of course, minds.
Yeah.
But some of the photographers that are in the early rip-it-ups went on to become like named photographers with works in Te Papa and stuff. So, and a couple of them are dead, so they've got trusts looking after their assets and stuff and their catalogues. So we've had to go to each of these people and say, you know, do you mind? It's not a high-res photograph. I'm not putting up a 600 dpi photograph. It's a very, very low res. And we've had absolutely no negativity at all. Not a single one.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So people have been enthusing about it, saying, yes, please put my stuff up.
That's
a couple of writers said, can I re-edit my stuff?
Can I do a redux for 2019?
Yeah, I'm kind of the same. I was thinking, a couple of those reviews I wrote are a bit dodgy. So,
but I guess like in order to understand the context, you've got to just kind of leave it as it is and just kind of see how there is difference now. And
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
and totally. There's all that social side of things too, which I love. I love all the rumours columns in there, because you know every month Murray would put a rumours column from each major city in the country, and so you have these things, up and coming things, and it says, you know, young Martin Phillips from Dunedin has decided to form a band. He's thinking of calling it the Chill.
Oh wow!
And that's not necessarily in there, but that sort of stuff, you know.
Yeah,
so you have all this stuff going through, and interactions between people, or people who later became famous writing rude letters to Rip It Up, like Russell Brown to Rip It Up saying, I think you guys have sold out.
Oh, that's a big call, Russell. He's always been there for that, though.
Yeah, and of course he was hired as a writer. And Murray actually really liked the letter he wrote, so he actually approached him, I think, and said, that's a great letter you wrote, even though I don't agree with it. Do you want to write for us?
What a way to deal with the situation. That's such a positive Murray way of doing it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I love that. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Simon. I really appreciate you calling today. And thank you much, like, to have this kind of recognition of sort of the context that we've all grown out of since then is so important. And
well, it's who we are, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So I'm going to be spending a good amount of time going through all these, trying to find all my favorite bands.